Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Hello. Welcome, welcome, listeners. My name is Karen Allen, as you know, and welcome to La Femme de Prose, the interview and podcast show for Focus on Women magazine. Wow, my guest today travels all over the place. She is the chief executive officer for Compassion and Choices. She and I have met before. I have interviewed this wonderful woman before. She is a woman who has a lot of information, and she is very, very busy. And I'm so grateful to you, Kim Callinan, for coming on La Femme de Prose today to talk to me yet again. You are a wealth of information. The subject is a serious one: death with dignity legislation, medical aid in dying. You were promoted to this office fairly recently after being the chief program officer for several years. And that's how I met you. And wow, I learned a lot about this subject. This is, it's not an easy subject, but it's a subject that we need to talk about more and more because people with terminal illnesses want more control of their lives. So Kim, welcome to the show. And thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule, because you are on a train, on everywhere, traveling across the country for your job, for Compassion and Choices. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen. And I did want to say that when I served as the chief program officer, you were the very first interview that I ever did. So you will always have a warm spot in my heart for giving me my first opportunity to speak about this issue to the media. So thank you for that.
I did not know that. And I just want to mention that was not for this radio show. That was for my talk show, Forward Motion, if I may just plug that while I'm doing this. Wait, that's wonderful. I'm so glad, because I would never have known the difference. You are a veteran either way. We're talking today about the same subject, only we're further along, actually. Things have progressed since then. That was a couple of years ago, and of course you're a veteran now. But first of all, I did not realize that there's a difference, and maybe most people don't, between what people have called physician-assisted suicide and medical aid in dying. Can you please address that first?
Sure. So some people use the terminology physician-assisted suicide to describe medical aid in dying. And the reality is that there is nothing at all. When you think about medical aid in dying, it's really about empowerment. It's about a person who is terminally ill, who is at the end of their life and a disease is killing them. And they are merely deciding how it is that they want to die. And for some of them, some people, having a prescription medication gives them the peace of mind of knowing that they will not suffer at the very end. So the term, the correct term to use when you're talking about this medical practice, is medical aid in dying. Opponents often refer to it as physician-assisted suicide. And the reality is this isn't suicide. The person is already dying. So that in and of itself is an incorrect term. And then it's really not accurate to say that it's physician-assisted, because one of the requirements of the law is that the person is able to self-ingest the medication. They actually have to be able to take the medication themselves. So the notion that the physician is assisting them is a little bit misleading. So the correct terminology for the medical practice when a person is mentally capable, terminally ill, has a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, and self-ingest the medication so that they can die peacefully in their sleep, the correct terminology to refer to that practice is medical aid in dying.
Because physician-assisted suicide is what you conjure up when you think back to the Dr. Kevorkian days, and he was trying to help people in his own way. Eventually, he got convicted, even though what he was trying to do was actually help people, but he obviously went a bit too far, or there's a whole history back there of what happened when he actually did try to assist someone to end their life, even though his motives were the same as to help a terminally ill person who had agreed that wanted to end their life, correct? Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So in the case of what Dr. Kevorkian did and what, you know, I would consider physician-assisted suicide, the doctor was injecting the medication into the person, and that's also referred to as euthanasia. And what the legislation that we're talking about doing is something that the patient controls from start to finish. They have to make the request. They have to be able to take the medication themselves.
Right. And even then, Dr. Kevorkian had attempted to try to get the person to turn his own switch. But anyway, long story. Times have changed since then, and now it's the point, as you said, is control. It's absolutely control. And now there are several states that have already okayed this and said, and there's laws on the books in Oregon, Washington, Vermont, California, Colorado, and now D.C. is the most recent. Is that right?
Yes. Hawaii actually just passed legislation this past week. So that was our really exciting news. And Montana is also another state. And I can't remember if you said Vermont in your list. So we're making considerable progress. Yeah, we're making very considerable progress, especially with Hawaii just authorizing the legislation last week.
Yeah, Hawaii. I forgot to mention them. That was actually in the material that I should be, should have read more carefully. But in any case, right. And there's several states, of course, are considering this. Many states are actually considering this. The thing about it is those who oppose it have a lot of considerations that they're talking about. And they what they want to do is address the reasons why terminally ill patients want to end their lives. What they say are statistics. And I know that Compassion and Choices addresses those. Can you talk about some of those? One is the fact that terminally ill patients talk about the fact that they lose autonomy, that they are being a burden, and that they are in pain. How does Compassion and Choices address that?
Sure. So I think our general philosophy is that a person who is terminally ill, mentally capable, and they have a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, that they should have the autonomy to make the decision about how they want to end their life. And when you look at the data, there's a host of reasons that people choose to get the prescription. Some people choose it because of loss of autonomy. Others choose it because of pain. Most people choose it because of fear of suffering. And most people choose it because of the combined experiences that they have. People choose to get the prescription medication because they have a fear that they're going to suffer. And very, very few people choose to actually take the prescription. And the reality is that it's just about the way a patient feels empowered that's important. And it's important that medicine and society recognizes that the choice and the decision should rest with the patient. They're already going to die from the disease. We should give them the dignity to be able to decide how it is that they die.
It's a significant truth that people don't want to be a burden on their relatives. It's understandable. I don't think that that's a mental health issue when you are truly feel you're going to be a burden. And the loss of autonomy I can understand that. Any one of us can understand that. And also, I wanted to address pain for a second. It's true that palliative care has come a long, long way. I was on the board of the Maryland Palliative Care Hospice Board, actually, a long time ago. Okay, this is decades ago. And so it's come a long way since then. Hospice has become something that we talk about and doctors talk about much, much more, and it's become more accepted and more acceptable. At the time, doctors weren't telling their patients because they didn't want to tell patients that they were terminal, and it turned out that patients really wanted and needed to know, but that conversation was hard to have. I don't know if you remember this, but you must, of course, but you're
yeah.
so young. Now that that conversation is being had more, palliative care has grown more. So once you can say it both ways, avoiding pain and getting painkillers is both prolonging life and making life, more than 6 months, in a way, because people will want to live longer, and also making it less hard to suffer. So you want, in a way, it goes both ways. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do follow what you're saying. I mean, the reality is we have tremendous palliative care in this country. And for those listeners who don't know what palliative care is, it's just simply the controlling of pain and the making a person feel more comfortable. And as a practice, that really has evolved over the past 30 years. And I think sometimes some doctors, not all, that are palliative care doctors, feel as if it's their duty and that their success rests on their ability to 100% control a patient's pain, and that this option, therefore, shouldn't be necessary. But what we hear over and over again from patients is that it's not just about what medicine can do for them. It's about them having the control and knowing that they have the option available to them. So there are still situations with about 25% of the time there's some form of breakaway pain that palliative medicine is not able to keep in control. So the idea that in all instances and all times that you'll be able to control pain is just not accurate. Everybody's body reacts differently, so sometimes pain can't be controlled. But in addition to that, suffering is a really, really broad term, and people suffer in lots of different ways. And some of the diseases that are now taking people's lives are really horrendous. Like, we have used medicine to extend life, and as a result of that, people are dying harder deaths. When you look at some of the deaths from cancer after the body has been ravaged through these aggressive chemotherapy treatments, the way someone suffers is just horrific. And what we hear over again is, I actually want to know that I have the option of medical aid in dying, because I know the results of this very aggressive treatment option are going to really leave my body in really bad shape and result in a much harder death. And if I know on the other end of trying all aggressive treatments that I have access to something that's going to make it so I don't suffer at the very end and die in pain, that gives me more comfort in trying the aggressive treatment. So it's really just an option. Very few people choose to use it, but it's really empowering for a patient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wanted to talk about psychiatric care and screenings, like depression.
Sure.
A lot of the other people who oppose this say that impaired judgment has a lot to do with making this choice. Can you address the fact that you say, and you've said throughout the show, that a mental health screening, that people in their, you know, you have to have the judgment to be able to decide that you want medical aid in dying. How do we go about that? How does that factor into making the decision?
Sure. So in the current legislation, there are actually two different doctors are required to ensure that a person meets the eligibility criteria. And one of the eligibility criteria is that the person is mentally capable of making an informed healthcare decision. So this does not mean that the person could not suffer from some form of dementia. I mean, you're at the very end of your life, and some form of depression. They can't have dementia, or advanced dementia, but that they can't, they may suffer from some form of depression. They're at the end of their life. It's a hard time. Sure, somebody could be sad or upset about it. That's different than somebody not being able to make an informed decision. So the person has to understand what I'm doing is something that will end my life. They have to understand the consequences of their action. They have to understand and be able to weigh the pros and cons of the decision that they're looking at. And in my experience and in talking to many, many, many patients who want to access this law, it's really pretty clear for them. They are at the very end of their life. They're suffering. The quality of their life is really low. They really just want to be able to say goodbye, surrounded by their friends, and knowing that they are doing that at a time before their health spirals to a place that's just really, really awful and painful. And that's what it's about. But they're very clear about what they want. And there's two doctors who are evaluating them to make sure that they're clear about the decision that they're making.
Yeah, that was what I was wondering. Once you go to one doctor and he says, he signs off on you, are you then referred to a mental health professional? Are there two mental health professionals? Is it different in each state, or how does that work?
In most of the states, it's two different two different physicians. There is not a requirement for a mental health professional to do a screening. In the same way, if somebody chooses palliative sedation, like right now a person has the right to say, I'm in so much pain and I'm suffering so much, I want to go into a coma and then withhold food and water until I die. So that's legal and authorized in every state. There's no mental health screening for that. Your physician evaluates you and makes sure that you are competent. And physicians are evaluating people for competency every day when they come in and see them. I mean, that's what you go through your screening for. If the physician is unsure whether or not a person is mentally capable, then they refer them to a psychiatric screening, and that's when the mental health screening would take place. If you were to attempt to put a requirement for a mental health screening into the process, it would make it virtually impossible for a dying patient to get through the process in time. They already have two different doctors who are supposed to evaluate them. There is a waiting period. There are multiple attestation forms. The person is dying. There are very few doctors at the moment who are willing to practice. You've got health systems. Any Catholic health system is opted out. So you have health systems that are opting out. So a patient has to really want this option and work in order to be able to get through the existing process. So it would make the law meaningless if we were to add in additional requirements. And what the data shows us is very few people choose to use the law, and that very few people, in a doctor's opinion, are required, they get referred to the mental health counselor if that is something that's required.
And what if you choose to, you are frail and you are vulnerable and you are, you know, very, very sick and you are eligible, but your family opposes it and you are not strong enough to aggressively pursue what you want, and they are so opposed to it that you cannot achieve it yourself, and your family won't let you do it.
Yeah, unfortunately, you wouldn't make it through the process. So, and what I would say is an unfortunate part of the law. The law right now weighs the patient's safety over the speed and ease at getting through the law. And the result of that is that there are a lot of patients, you know, if the prognosis is happening at 6 months or less is when the person will actually is eligible for it. Most people don't have any idea that this is something that they want to consider. And they get to the very end, and most doctors are not making the prognosis of 6 months or less when the person really has 6 months or less to live because it's imperfect. So, and doctors are hesitant to actually tell somebody that they're that close to death. And so generally speaking, what happens is a person doesn't find out that that they're terminally ill with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live until the 3 month mark. And then this process starts if they're right away, they know this is something they want to consider. And if you think about the length of time it takes to find a doctor who will practice and then a second doctor who will practice, and then there's a 15-day waiting period and all other requirements, it's really quite a challenge to get through the law as is. So hopefully, as people become more comfortable with this as a practice, we can see people evaluate 40 years of data across 7 jurisdictions and see that there are too many regulatory requirements in place. And we can take a look at that and remove some of them. But right now, as the laws were created, they were created with the safety, making sure that there is no risk of coercion taking place. And so that is the value that has been dominant in how the laws have been crafted. And we've proven that. There has been, 40 years of combined data across 6 jurisdictions, and there hasn't been a single incidence of abuse or coercion. There has, however, been lots of evidence of patients who want to access the law who can't get through the process.
In fact, here in the district where we are speaking, actually I am speaking in the DMV, the district, tri-state area, there was a gal who actually couldn't find a doctor to work with her. as she has written lately in an editorial that you and I both saw. And this gal is a terminally ill patient and a former journalist, and she cannot find a doctor in the district to actually work with her to access this medication. What's up with that, Kim? Do you think that that is widespread, or what? Why is that happening? Because on the other hand, you say that the statistics show that people just really want the ability to have that control, but they most often don't use it. Here's a gal who wants to use it who can't find a doctor to work with her.
Yeah, so it does happen. I mean, for sure, in every state. In Washington, D.C., the problem is much more widespread. And we actually launched a week of compassion last week in an attempt to find Mary Klein, who's the woman that you're referencing, and other D.C. residents that have contacted us in an attempt to help them access the law. In the 14 months since the D.C. law has been in effect, not a single person has been able to access the law. And there's a couple of reasons for this. First of all, the D.C. law has been under attack via Congress since it was first implemented. And so it's really slowed down the pace at which implementation efforts have taken place. The second problem is that the Department of Health in Washington, D.C., and I'm sure they had the best of intentions, but they implemented regulatory requirements that were much, much more bureaucratic than the kinds of requirements that were done in other states. So they took the law that was put in place and they added to it. They made doctors register on a website, and doctor has to register the patient's name on a website. And they added a bunch of forms to the practice, and they made it more difficult for pharmacists to participate. And so they really started to regulate the practice of medicine, whereas the other states took the law at face value and really collected the data and allowed the practice of medicine to practice the way it always does, which is, you know, which is under the guidelines of medicine. You know, doing something like requiring a doctor to register on a website and fill out extra forms for a practice that so few people are going to use, there's not a lot of incentive for a doctor to want to do that. So that's made it harder to find doctors. I think the health systems have been less inclined to develop policies when the law was under attack in Congress. And as a result, as dying residents have contacted us like Mary, you know, they really just keep hitting roadblocks. So we did our week of compassion last week to raise awareness about this problem and really bring together all of the different stakeholders who are involved in this issue and call upon them to make sure that we're bringing compassion to this law instead of forcing patients into regulatory roadblocks.
And nobody came forward? No doctor still?
No, we've had some doctors who we've had some doctors who have now come forward and some health systems who've now come forward who seem like they're interested and willing to work with Mary. And that is in the works. So there is she has not yet gotten through the process. We haven't found a doctor who's registered and you know, but we do have some leads that lend us to feel optimistic about Mary. But there's a bigger systemic problem. So even though some health systems have come forward and said, you know, we'll look at our policy, and some doctors have come forward and said, you know, I think I can help Mary. We still have other patients who are going to need to access the law, and we can't hold a press conference every time a dying person can't access the law. So what we ultimately need is for the Department of Health to use the model from other states that have implemented this law successfully and reduce the number of regulatory roadblocks that are in place.
Right. And also there's a question of, I hate to say this, but does insurance cover this? And I hate to say this, but is it profitable? Because that's what insurance cares about. They don't necessarily, you know, do this for fun.
Right. So there are a couple of different protocols that are available in order to access the law. Private health insurance companies historically have covered this. And in each state, when a new law is authorized, we work with the insurance companies to get them to cover this. And so far, by and large, the private health insurance companies have agreed to cover the medication and the practice. the challenge that we have is on the government programs. So at a federal level, there is a funding act called the Assisted Suicide Funding Restriction Act. And in it, they specifically ban federal funds from being used to pay for medical aid in dying. And even though they call it the Assisted Suicide Funding Restriction Act, and we would argue that this is not assisted suicide, they defined it in the act in this way. So it very clearly extends to medical aid in dying. So federal funds are not allowed to be used, which means that Medicare can't be used to cover the practice. And if the state does not have a separate Medicaid program, if the funds are commingled, the state's Medicaid program cannot be used. So in all of the states except for Colorado and D.C., the state Medicaid programs do cover it because the states have extended it. But the they cannot extend federal money for the use of this unless at some point the Assisted Suicide Funding Restriction Act gets repealed.
That seems positively tragic, frankly.
Yeah, it really is.
Really ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Yeah. It really is.
Okay, just briefly, when it comes to faith, the religious factor, they just don't agree in any way with this. Is there any way that do you lobby them at all? Does your organization try to work with the churches and try to see if there's any way that you can show them that this is, you know, in the best interest of the patient to control their own life and death?
Well, I guess I would separate out the establishment from actually the people themselves. It doesn't matter what religion somebody is. If you look across all different religious groups, the majority of people support this. So whether you're a Catholic or a Protestant, I don't know that I have down to like Hindus and Buddhists, but, you know, in polling data, it really across all religious groups, you have the majority support and in many instances, the vast majority of support. Even when you look at the leadership level, we do have some support at the leadership level in different religions. We have a whole faith leadership group of people who have signed on to letters for us. So leaders of various different faiths who've come forward to say, you know, this is what a compassionate death is all about. It's about recognizing and honoring a patient's wishes. So we have leadership across various different faith groups. And then we also have support from different congregations and denominations. So we do, as an example, the Unitarians, not surprisingly, were the first church group to come along. The United Church of Christ as a whole still does not have a supportive policy, but many, many United Church of Christ themselves or within states do. And then across various different other faiths, we see some various levels of support. Where we see the greatest opposition is at the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. It's not among Catholics themselves. It's among the actual leadership. And I don't know, like, I don't imagine that they will change their mind, but this is a really different pope. And so, you know, I always hope that, you know, the pragmatic side that recognizes that we're using medicine to extend one's life. It's hard to argue that we shouldn't then allow medication to be used to allow somebody to die peacefully. So I'm always the optimist.
As well you should be. Well, Kim Callanan, thank you so much for joining us. Kim is the CEO of Compassion and Choices. All the best to you. Thank you again for joining us. And as Kim says goodbye, I'm going to tell you how to get in touch with Kim and her organization. Thank you so much, Kim. Take care.
Thank you so
we'll
much, Karen. It's always. Thank you. It's always so much fun. I really appreciate it. Bye-bye.
You are the best. Take care. Bye-bye. So, folks, before I say goodbye, compassionandchoices.org. You can find out more about that organization. And, of course, on Wikipedia, there's all you need to know and on the Internet about this issue. Take care, everybody. Thanks for listening. And this is Karen Allen, Focus on Women magazine. The name of the show is La Femme de Prose. And we will see you on the Internet next time.